You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The president had a press conference this afternoon. Basically said he's open to any ideas that don't hurt the middle class to raise revenue, but it looks like basically let's let the Bush tax cuts expire, go back to the Clinton tax rates, at least on the top 2%, and then he can negotiate a tax cut for everybody else, the bottom 98%. And if they simply let the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year, then all those guys in Congress who have sworn a blood oath to multimillionaire lobbyist, K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist, will not be humiliated and horrified. Right? So they can say, oh, yeah, no, we're going to give a tax cut to the middle class. We had nothing to do with those taxes going up. That happened automatically. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. Also, more on Benghazi and Lindsey Graham, and I want to get into all that as we continue through the program. Right now, Tom Pawkin is back with us. It's been a while since Tom's been on the program. I don't recall exactly how long, but Tom, great to have you back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Tom Pawkin, his last name is spelled P-A-U-K-E-N. His website is tompawkin.com. He's a former Reagan White House staff member, commissioner of the Texas Workforce Commission, and the author of Bringing America Home, How America Lost Her Way and How We Can Find Our Way Back. And Tom, David Frum, we've had several conversations with him over the last year or so, and you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he and a number of other thoughtful conservatives have suggested that the Republican Party, the part of the Republican Party that calls itself severely conservative or very conservative or libertarian conservative or Tea Party conservative has just gone nuts. That this is not the kind of conservatives that Barry Goldwater recognized. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, David Frum is a neoconservative, and he was one of the architects from the sidelines of the Bush policy to impose democracy on the Middle East through military interventionism, a very ill-suited policy, which ironically has been continued by the Obama administration. And I think our failures in the Middle East during the Bush administration are principal reason why he became very unpopular and Barack Obama was elected president. But quite frankly, under the Obama administration, you've got Hillary Clinton with her Arab Spring policy, which is indirectly engage in regime change. I think we've made a heck of a mess in the Middle East, and we better start rethinking what we're doing over there and consider the law of unintended consequences when you get rid of governments and impose new regimes that may be even worse. So I'm not a big fan of Frum's generally because he and Richard Perle, in fact, co-authored a book praising this idea that we're going to impose U.S.-style democracy in the Middle East.
Well, I don't want to hang this whole thing on David Frum. My point is it seems to, and frankly, I think that you and I probably agree on more with regard to Middle East policy and non-interventionism than we disagree. But these guys who are talking about forcible rape and these guys who are going off on how, you know, on secession, we've got this conversation going on. You've got 8 or 9 members of the state house up in Wisconsin or Minnesota right now talking about arresting any federal officials who want to implement Obamacare and dare step foot in their state. I mean, this is the lunatic fringe on steroids.
Problem, Tom, and that's why I think Frum doesn't get it at all. The real problem is you've had in the post-Reagan period nothing but what I would call Rockefeller-style Republicans, Wall Street guys, private equity guys like Mitt Romney being our nominees, or people beholden to, if you will, the big financial institutions. Yeah. And the problem is we've gotten away from our middle class base and we really need to move back to being concerned about what the average American is worried about. And you and I've talked on this program before about the need to bring manufacturing home to the U.S. Yep. And start growing the private sector and getting good paying jobs back here. And we need to change the business tax system. Neither party right now is talking about that. They're all focused on this you know, the personal income tax side, but the reality is the bigger problem is you got a business tax system which rewards debt, which is great for the corporate buyout artists because they load companies up with debt and ship the jobs overseas, but it's terrible for American businesses and workers. And
yeah, so, no, I agree with you on that. And in fact, I, you know, it sounds so often to me like, you know, when we have these conversations, and I believe I've said this overtly in the past, that you're talking like my dad used to talk, who considered himself an
Eisenhower Republican.
An Eisenhower Republican and a Goldwater conservative.
Sure.
And
Goldwater used to say, our job is not to represent big business, big labor, or big government, but the forgotten Americans, the middle class taxpayers who don't have lobbyists in Washington and aren't looking for loopholes in the law. And we've gotten away from that.
So let's talk about this business tax. You have the most recent piece that you have up over at TomPawkin.com is called Taxing Our Way to Prosperity. And, you know, there's some, respectfully, there's some of the gratuitous rhetoric about, oh, my God, taxes in there. But you get into this point that basically, I would have gotten into it by starting out that Alexander Hamilton, you know, put tariffs on imported goods in 1793, and we built the United States. So our average tariff from 1795 until the mid-1980s in the United States, tariff on imported goods was 30.5%, I think, was the average of all those years. It went as low as 29%. It went as high as 42%. But it averaged around 30%. And you know, Reagan and then Clinton and I mean, to this day, President Obama, now our average tariffs are well under 2%. And other countries, in response to joining the WTO and whatnot, you know, and getting on this whole global free trade thing, have said, okay, fine, we'll do away with tariffs, taxes on imported goods too. But what we're going to do is put into place a value-added tax on anything manufactured, and we'll reverse that tax out on exports. So we'll impose that tax on imports. So it functionally becomes a tariff.
You're absolutely right. I call it a stealth tariff, and I use the example of a U.S.-made Cadillac shipped to Germany, a 35% corporate tax rate here, 7.65 employer portion of the payroll tax. Price it at $50,000 to compete against a Mercedes-Benz. You're hit at the German border with a 19% border-adjusted consumption tax.
Right.
They have, and so you're at a huge disadvantage, and on average we're at an 18% disadvantage with our trading competitors, and it's not just the low-wage nations. Germany has a very strong manufacturing sector, and yet it has a high wage and high social service cost structure. So that German vehicle coming into the U.S., we have no border-adjusted consumption tax, and as you point out, Tom, they get a tax credit against their business consumption tax back home. So I'm saying get rid of the existing system, put in a border-adjusted consumption tax in the 8-9% range. It would be whatever would be revenue neutral,
right.
And all of a sudden you're leveling the playing field.
I'm totally with you, Tom. We just have a minute left.
No longer rewarding debt.
We just have a minute left. How do we get Republicans and Democrats to talk about a VAT tax, about a value-added tax, or you call it, a consumption tax?
There are some Democrats. Fritz Hollings is talking about it. Paul Ryan's come out in favor, but he doesn't echo a word about it. Jim DeMint is in favor of it. Pat Choate, an independent who ran with Ross Perot, has endorsed it. I think Erskine Bowles came out for it the other day, as did Paul O'Neill, who was Secretary of Treasury and fired, I think, by Dick Cheney because he warned about the deficit levels.
Right.
But they're all in favor of this concept, so I think it's gaining ground, and this is one where, Tom, I think business and labor can come together and people on the left and right can come together.
I agree.
I mean, I just hate to see that neither side up there is talking about this thing now, and this is an opportunity to really bring people together and start bringing the jobs home to America.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Tom Pawkin, and you can read his piece over in his first principles piece over at TomPawkin, PAUKEN.com. It's really a worthy read. Former Reagan White House staff member, commissioner of the Texas Workforce Commission, and author of Bringing America Home. Tom, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Always good talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No, I am not losing my mind. Occasionally, conservatives actually have interesting, useful, positive things to say. We need more of them in America.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I am just about to be brilliant.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Indeed. Tom Hartman here with you. I thought there was a table. Here it is. It's in this piece that Tom Pawkin wrote. And again, Tom Pawkin is an old-fashioned Barry Goldwater, Dwight Eisenhower, Republican, conservative, not a crazy man. And which is, you know, why he's not a member of Congress, because he's not crazy. I mean, this is what it takes these days if you want to be a Republican elected official. You got to do stupid stuff like Lindsey Graham saying, "Oh, Mr. President, I think that that's just, you know, you're guilty." And he's and well, I don't know. It's just terrible. But over the past decade, Tom Pawkin writes, there's been zero private sector job growth in the United States. Well, of course, that's because, you know, we deregulated everything and drank the Kool-Aid in the late 90s. Now, people blame this on the Obama administration, but really what happened was that was the era of soft money. You got to be a real political wonk to remember this, but there were changes in the law, and as I recall, there was even a Supreme Court decision that had something to do with this, that while you still couldn't give unlimited amounts of money to a candidate, you could give large amounts of money, or maybe it was the bundling, whatever it was. It was called soft money. And you could just pour enormous amounts of money through the political parties into the political process. And as a consequence of that, all of a sudden the political parties started paying attention to the agendas of the people who could write the big checks, like Wall Street. And so we saw Glass-Steagall ended. And we saw the Commodities Future Modernization Act, the two things that led directly to the crash of 2006, 7, and 8. This stuff happened as a consequence of money pouring into our politics. Similarly, we have had for the last three decades money pouring into our politics, saying to our politicians, you know, big transnational corporations, big companies like General Electric or Apple or Microsoft doesn't so much manufacture, but if they did, I'm sure they'd be on that list. Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, on the list goes. Companies that used to make everything here in the United States. Saying, you know, we can make more profit if we can make this stuff in a cheap labor country and then bring it into the United States. The only problem is that we've got these import tariffs here in the United States that prevent us from moving our factories overseas. And so let's do away with those tariffs. And on top of that, give us a tax deduction for tearing a factory down in the United States and building it in Shenzhen, China. And lo and behold, they got it. So what Tom is suggesting is that we put in place a value-added tax, a VAT tax. Now, the way a value-added tax works is that every stage in the manufacturing process that adds value to a product, you tax that. You tax that added value. Very small tax, but at each stage it's added. So when the iron ore comes in and it's made into iron, you've added value to it, you tax that. When the iron is made into steel, you tax that. When the steel is rolled into flat steel, you tax that. When the flat steel is made into a door for a car, you tax that. When the door is assembled to the car and the car is made, you tax that. Each step along the way, small taxes. So that it all adds up to more or less by the time that car is done, from the time the iron ore first came into the United States until or was mined in the Upper Peninsula until the time that the car rolls off the assembly line and goes into the showroom, you've got somewhere in the neighborhood of a 15 to 20% tax on it, a value-added tax. And anything that gets imported into the United States, like if you want to import a car into the United States, you say, you know, there's about 20% worth of value added in that car, so we're going to collect that at the border. So all of a sudden, every import into the United States becomes 20% more expensive. It's functionally a tariff. And then on exports, you say, okay, if we're going to make this car here in the United States and there's a 18% value added tax on it, but it's going to be exported. Because the value-added tax is theoretically a consumption tax, it's a tax paid by consumers, American consumers, then we'll reverse that tax out when this product is exported. So if that car gets sold in Germany, there's an 18% discount off the price because the value-added tax is deducted. I first really got this. I was in Australia a decade or a half ago or so, and Neil Donald Walsh and I were doing a tour all around the country speaking on on his books, Conversation with God, and my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And I had either forgot or it got ruined. I forget which it was, but I didn't have a sports coat. And so I went into this store and I bought a sports coat. It was a fairly nice one. I mean, it wasn't, you know, absurdly expensive, but it was more than nothing. And the guy gave me a receipt. And he said, when you get to the airport, be sure to go to the VAT tax window with this receipt. Because there was like a 15 or 20% VAT tax on this sports coat. So when I got to the airport, I presented my receipt and they gave me like 80 or 100 bucks or something. I mean, it was quite a bit of money. So, or maybe it was more like 50 or 60, but whatever it was, I was impressed. And that's when I started thinking, wow, you know, this is a replacement for tariffs. It was my introduction to it. And here's how it actually works. Right now, the United Kingdom, their VAT tax, what they charge on imported goods is 20%. The discount on exported goods, 20% in the UK. In France, it's 19.6%. In Germany, it's 19%. The average of the EU 15 most developed countries, 20.7%. Canada, 13%. China, 17%. Yes, China charges a VAT tax when we export goods to them. You say you take a car, General Motors car, and ship it to China, 17% VAT tax on import. Mexico, 16%. They're no dummies. India, 12.5%. Japan is 5%, although the Japanese have figured out all these other ways to add to that with fees and whatnot. We do none of that. We're sitting here stupid and naked because of 32 years of Reaganomics and this whole idea of free trade. Let's wake up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Here's a marvelous opportunity. If you have a Republican representing you in Congress, tell him to go read Tom Pawkins' piece on taxing our way to prosperity. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, my question, as it were, I've been pretty blunt about this. I wrote a book about this stuff, Rebooting the American Dream, how we can change our trade policies, how we can change our fiscal policies, how we can change our taxation policies in ways that will make America competitive. Tom Pawkin writing about it. I think it's when a serious progressive commentator, and I realize, you know, at a certain level, in the minds of some, a commentator on talk radio and being serious are, you know, not to be in the same sentence. But, and I don't take myself all that seriously, but I really do try to bring a level of intellectual honesty and integrity to these debates and to these discussions that we have, you and I have every day on the radio and on the television, and that we all have as a nation. And when a progressive commentator, that would be me, and a conservative Republican, that would be Tom Pawkin, agree. Now, around the fringes, there may be some disagreement on you know, philosophy or policy or whatever, but basically agree that it's time for the United States to adopt a VAT tax, a value-added tax. And yet, I would bet you that if you just, you know, walk around the shopping mall and bump into the, you know, 10, 15 people and ask them, can you tell me what VAT and VAT tax stands for? They would give you a blank look. Or do you know what a VAT tax is? Or do you know what a value-added tax is? I would be surprised if one in a thousand Americans knows the answer to that question. And it's something that a thousand of a thousand Americans should know. We should all know. We should all be discussing it. How to use a value-added tax the way that Canada does, the way Australia does, the way that Germany does, the way the UK does, the way that France does, to encourage exports and discourage imports. In other words, to create a semi-permeable membrane around the country, an economic membrane that protects domestic jobs. Those countries without them stand naked before the world, like us and Somalia. And that's the direction we're heading. The libertarian paradise of Somalia. And those countries with them are doing quite well. Thank you very much. So, anyway, something to toss out into the mix. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to understand the VAT tax concept, but I'd like to propose an alternative, and it would be one that I think leaves government a little bit less involved. I guess one of the things I'm having trouble getting my head around is how do you decide what exactly you put a VAT tax in? So an alternative that would more or less create that same boundary, but allow the market to really compete would be one, in a simplistic way, you basically say, if you want to sell it here, meaning the United States, then you've got to build it here in the United States. It could be foreign companies. It could be domestic companies. It could be anybody who wants to compete. But if you're going to sell in the United States market, you have to use U.S. employees.
But what you're talking about, Mike, is essentially a form of prohibition. You're saying if, states try to do this with tobacco. Well, actually, it's not. You have to make it here as the tax differential. But my point is that I think that kind of a policy will do is create a black market in crime. How are you going to enforce that? You're going to have guys with guns at every border looking at everything that comes into this country, and particularly things that are very small and very valuable, microchips and whatnot. Are you going to catch them all? How do you enforce that?
Well, how do you enforce a VAT tax?
Well, you have border inspectors. It's the way that we used to enforce tariffs. And in fact, a novel I wrote back in the 80s, which was never published, but the MacGuffin of the novel, the plot device of the novel was that a company in the United States, this was back when we had tariffs, a company in the United States was exporting to Germany, or importing from Germany, rather, and didn't want to have to pay the tariffs. And so the German company, on $100,000 worth of goods, would produce an invoice that said it was only $10,000 worth of goods. So they'd pay the tariff on $10,000 worth of goods rather than $100,000. And then the American company, by back channel, would pay the $90,000 to the German company without, having it attached to the product. The problem, and a lot of that kind of thing happened, by the way, in the United States. I mean, I got the idea for doing that from a news story about a company that had gotten busted doing that. But we busted people for it. But I'm concerned that if you say you must make it here, I'm a big fan of the old saying in business, never say no, just say here's how much it'll cost you. If somebody comes to my business and says, can you do a, when I owned the ad agency, can you produce a 32-page, color glossy magazine for Holiday Inn? And at that time, we were making 4-page newsletters and we were a small company. I didn't say no. I said, yes, here's the price. We got the contract. Sometimes you price things so high that it's effectively no, but just to say no, to do an absolute prohibition, my guess is that what you would end up with is a black market in imported goods.
No, and I think that's a legitimate concern. How do you decide what products get a VAT tax? And I guess my concern there is, do you drive the same type of need for special interests where now special industries and those with money can find ways to try to get special favors?
Well, there's largely international consensus on how VAT taxes work and at what stages in production they're produced. And with regard to tariffs, we still have on the books. You can go over to the U.S. Department of Trade and see them online. I've looked through them. We have 22,000 tariffs on the books right now. Rolled steel, steel bars, thin steel, fat steel. I mean, there's probably 150 of them just for different types of steel. And all of them used to be, 10, 12%, 16%, 22%, 91%. I mean, they used to be all over the map, but they used to average out to around 25 or 30%. Now they're 0.01%, 0.3%. I mean, we still actually collect tariff revenue on imported goods. We still charge tariff revenue. But it's so insignificant that companies just don't care. And so with the VAT tax, the easy way to calculate it is you say, okay, let's say it's 5% on the increased value of a product. So when that steel becomes a door, when as steel it was worth $100, as a door it's worth $1,000, you've got a $900 increase in value there. 5% of $900 is $45. That's your tax. And, you know, it's simple math. So that's how it would work, and that's what I would do with that. But, you know, it's a thought. Mike, thanks for the call. Tom in Chester, New York. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on? I just got a question about all this talk with the fiscal cliff coming up.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the VAT tax. You're talking basically taxes. I come from the conservative point of view, and I always wondered, what happens when the government does shut down? I mean, I heard once before, not everything stops.
Well, first of all, this fiscal cliff negotiation has nothing to do with shutting the government down. It has to do with the Bush tax cuts expiring, which they would have done 2 years ago, because you can only pass legislation the last 10 years by reconciliation, and the Bush tax cuts were pushed through by reconciliation, so they couldn't be filibustered. And then Obama extended them for 2 years, but they're going to expire automatically at the end of the year. So that's the revenue, the tax piece of it. The spending piece of it came out of this sequestration agreement that these guys had, where, you know, if they couldn't come up with a grand bargain, then they were going to cut, millions, billions of dollars out of the defense budget plus out of social programs. And frankly, the cuts to the defense budget don't even take us back to where we were in 98.
Okay. Is that what they're talking about, across-the-board cuts, they kick in automatically?
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to? Yeah.
Yeah, but they're not really across-the-board. They carved out a whole bunch of exemptions for critical industries, for Medicare, for Medicaid, for people on disability. The only people that I think really will get hurt by this, if it lasts more than a week or so after the first of the year, are people on long-term unemployment, because those are federal checks. And they can catch up with that, too. But I think that what the Obama administration should do is put the legislation together right now, work it out, put it on the table, say, here it is, and January 2nd, let's all get together and vote on this. I don't know if that's a weekday or not. I don't have a calendar in front of me. But on the first Monday after the new year, let's all get together and vote on this and make it retroactive to December 31st. So there's absolute continuity. But on December 2nd, the Bush tax cuts will have expired, which means we'll be operating under the Clinton tax rates. And so this would be, and because it's a tax cut for the bottom 98% and the top 2% are simply left intact, all the Republicans who've sworn their life and their first child to multimillionaire lobbyist Grover Norquist can say, we didn't vote to raise taxes, we voted to cut taxes. Everybody wins.
Right. It's a big game. Half of the Republicans are for it, and some, the Tea Party members are against it, but in the end, they all seem to push it, they continue to spend.
Our spending is down substantially, Tom. It's, President Obama has reduced the number of federal employees by, I think, about 100,000 since he first came into office 4 years ago. There was a huge expansion, of course, under George W. Bush, but I don't see any big spending increases. Actually, I think they're dialing it down. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What's the best way to bring jobs back to America? I guess that's the bottom line here. I think a VAT tax or tariffs, good place to start. Yeah, our whole country does. It's a real tragedy. In fact, good chunks of the world have got the Reaganomics blues. Ron in Calgary, Canada. Is it Calgary or Calvary? It's Calgary, right?
Yeah, Calgary, Alberta, right-wing capital of Canada.
I have been there. It's a beautiful city. Yeah, in the mountains there.
When the city's nice, but the right-wing people are driving me nuts. And I'm so happy. I walk around with Obama sticker on my hat now.
Oh, my.
With the Texas emblem for the team out of Houston. Yeah. And I can tell if I'm in an upper-scale mall because everyone hates me.
Oh, my.
I go to the average person.
Well, that's where all the oil money is, so they're...
Well, not really. It's offshore. But the one thing I heard you talk about Canada a lot, and it's coming up more and more, And you should tell people on your show, and you should have people to do a rebuttal. My wife 4 years ago had colon cancer. She went to the hospital. She waited her normal time, had the operation. Everything was fine. She gets her checkups. I had three kids. I'm 71 years old. I'm still practicing as a professional engineer, and I can tell everyone in the United States of America, I haven't lost one night's sleep of getting a bill from the healthcare system.
Right. So your healthcare system was there for your wife, took care of her, solved.
Everything's fine. We don't pay no a copay. I'm going to get a T-shirt copay. What's that, eh?
What's that, eh?
Americans, get your head out of you. That's right. People, get your head out of your butts down there.
Yeah.
Travel more. I got a son that's working in London. He's transferred out to Abu Dhabi. I got my other son in Houston, two of them in Houston. And they're all saying that Americans are kind of slow down here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a problem. It's a problem. And it has to do, Ron, with our having an infotainment industry rather than actual news. I mean, you at least have the CBC there. That provides you with real news.
You know, we had a big fight about our right-wing Fox News up here. We didn't want it, but you know, they finally got in here.
Right.
But the problem is, when you talk to people, and I go to Moe's Bar, and I talk to one guy, I got a hell of a good health care. Yeah, but the trouble is I got to pay $3,500 by March 31st. I says, for what? Well, after that, everything's free. So I asked him, how many times did you go to the doctor last year? Twice.
Right.
So I'm thinking, you're an American, you're supposed to be the top of the food chain. You paid $1,700 to see a doctor.
Right.
He looked at me. I never thought of it that way. I said, get your head out of your butts, people.
Yeah. But you wanted to talk about the VAT tax. You call it in Canada GST taxes?
GST, yeah, it works like a charm. And the guy before is so worried. He's another gentleman who should get his head out of his butt.
Now, okay, let's stop using that metaphor, okay, Ron? I know. This is a family show. What does GST stand for?
Goods and services tax.
Okay, and so
I got a charge for my professional services. So I charge when I pay an invoice. The next guy takes it, and he can deduct it from his GST payment. So it works very well.
Right.
So the Europeans and everyone has a tax like that, but you guys just won't do it because you have this mantra, don't have taxes.
Right. Yeah, because it's got the word tax in it. Everybody here gets hysterical about it.
Yeah. You know, so to me, I worked there for about a year and a half in Colorado, and I've learned my medical and stuff, and I couldn't believe people when I told them. I've never had to worry about my health care, my wife, or my kids.
Right.
Now, who's a stronger person in the nation not worrying about it?
Yeah, I agree.
I can tell every boss I work to, just go away, I'm quitting, I can go across the street, and I have my medical that goes with me.
Right.
That's so powerful for a nation. You don't know how much worrying you'd save if you'd only smarten up, go to Obama and tell him, let's have single payer like we have in Canada.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to happen, and it's going to happen the same way it happened in Canada. Vermont has already passed the legislation. Governor Shumlin has already signed it into law. They're setting it up right now. It's going to go into effect in 2016, maybe 2014. I think it's 2016 when Obamacare allows states to do these things. Montana, I believe, it's passed the legislature. With you guys, it started in Saskatchewan and then it spread across the nation, from province to province. And they're still administered at the province level, right?
Oh, yes. See, that's the beauty of it. We have a federal mandate. This is a certain thing you have to provide. Then you provide it.
Right. And I think that's how it's going to happen here in the United States. I predict within a decade, within 10 years of this date, we will have the Canadian system here in the United States because it works. It makes more sense. And as you say, you know, you never have to worry about, you know, paying the bill. Here in the United States, half of all bankruptcies are caused by somebody getting sick. That's insane. You know, 45,000 people a year die because they lack access to health care. That's insane. We are crazy people down here, Ron. I got to tell you. Not crazy. We're malinformed, misinformed, underinformed. And similarly with the GST, with this VAT tax, you've got it up there in Canada. It works really well. It protects your exports. It encourages your exports. In fact, it protects your domestic manufacturing companies against imports, and it's a good thing. This is a rational thing. I don't understand why more people don't do it. Ron, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you, Charles in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to AM 950. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Say, I'm a sensory guerrilla marketing entrepreneur.
Okay.
I like to look at fixing problems in a collaborative way instead of fighting the other side.
Okay.
And so what distressed me, and I've listened to you on this issue too, about this last election, is that if the problem isn't brought up, you can't fix it And you've said over and over, until Citizens United is addressed and elections are federally funded, these guys can't bite the hands that feed them. So
right.
they're just going to keep campaigning and attacking the other side instead of saying what they're going to do.
I agree.
Doesn't Obama need to step up and in a 9-1-1 collaborative kind of way address the overhaul of Congress and how they're elected?
Well, it's going to require a constitutional amendment to do. It's going to require, and this is why I tell everybody, go to movetoamend.org, create a local chapter in your community. You can run it. This is a totally an organization of volunteers. They are growing like a weed, over 120 communities now. Maybe it's over 160. In fact, wasn't it over 300? It's some incredible number of communities. You'd have to go to movetoamend.org to get the number. Have passed resolutions saying we want a constitutional amendment that says two things, two very simple things. Corporations are not people, and money is property, not speech. And if you did those two things by constitutional amendment, it would reverse a whole series of absolutely insane Supreme Court decisions where the Supreme Court made law for us, thank you very much, that we didn't want, didn't need. And that's where it has to start. Charles, you put your finger right on it. But you cannot have publicly funded campaigns. You cannot have regulation of cash in the political sphere until you say the Supreme Court was wrong in Buckley versus Vallejo and in Citizens United when they said that money is speech or facilitates even speech, that it's not just property. Thanks a lot, Charles, for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple of quick and very important news points. Brasstown, North Carolina is facing a crisis. The annual possum drop has been declared illegal by a judge. Seriously. For the last 19 years, people come from all over the country to go to Brasstown, North Carolina and watch them take a possum, and it hangs by, you know, they hang by their tail and kind of play dead, hang by their tail there all, you know, all day on New Year's Day, and then at New Year's Eve they drop the possum. And this judge said, and I'm not making this up, the judge said that the possum and anybody who's hunting, he said you need to, you know, basically live by the code of hunters, which was defined by Patrick Henry when he said, give me liberty or give me death. In other words, you can eat the possum, but you can't mess with the possum. Serious stuff going on here in the United States. Oh, my. Somebody's math and the tariffs, the Wall Street Journal. Oh, yeah, Arizona. They're still trying to figure out what's going on in Arizona. They're saying December 4th now. This is what happens when you get right-wing Republican wackadoodles in charge of your electoral process. You know, in addition to all this, what I really wanted to rant about in this hour, and we will be picking up your calls in a little bit, but first, there's something that every single American family understands, that the conservatives, especially the so-called budget hawks, they don't want us to talk about. This is really important. This is civics 101. They don't want us to talk about the difference between spending and investing. You ever heard a Republican talk about investing? The government's investing. No. They say government spending. Let's assume that the typical American family collects its paycheck at the end of the month and decides to go out to eat for a fancy dinner, right? Big celebration. A couple glasses of wine, appetizer, four entrees, a few desserts later, the waiter brings the check. At least here in D.C., that family's now out about $150. Do that once a month as a special treat, you're pushing $2,000 a year. That money is not coming back. It was spent and is now gone. That's an example of spending. Now, let's assume that same family decided to skip those fancy dinners all year long, and instead they take that $2,000 and they put it into home repairs, like a new air conditioner, improved insulation, or a new rooftop. Unlike spending it on a fancy dinner, that money doesn't just disappear. It will actually create more money in the long run through lower energy bills and an increase in the value of their home. That's an investment. So we're all clear about the difference between spending and investing. Let's assume that that same family uses a chunk of their paycheck to start a prepaid college fund for their kids. Again, that money doesn't disappear. Instead, it was invested in the future for their kids to earn a college degree. Or maybe they just buy $150 worth of stock every month. Again, the money doesn't disappear. In fact, in a year, it might be worth $2,500. Another investment, assuming the market doesn't crash. Bottom line here, what I'm trying to say is American families, Americans, know the difference between spending and investing. And we know that when times are tough, we can cut back on spending. But we really don't want to cut back on the investments. If the roof is leaking, you fix it. That means fewer fancy dinners out, but no cuts to the kids' college fund or the mortgage payments. So why isn't the same logic applied to our government? Like a family, our government is capable of spending and investing. Money put into wars, perfect example of spending. As a nation, we spend $1 trillion deploying troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, manufacturing and detonating bunker-busting bombs, refueling aircraft carriers in the Gulf. Guess what happens to all that money? It's obliterated. War spending is just that, spending. It does not create more wealth in the future. The shards of a Predator drone's Tomahawk missile in northern Pakistan, well, I don't know if they use Tomahawk missiles in the Predator drones, but whatever, will not create one dime of lasting wealth for our nation. You know, we might as well have gone out and bought a few million big fancy steak dinners. There's no question about it. Our government spends a lot of money. When it comes to reducing our deficits, there's certainly a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse within that spending that can be cut, particularly in the Defense Department, which seems to have lost $2 trillion they can't account for. But let's not confuse spending with investing, which our government also does a lot of. For example, money put into Pell Grants so more kids can go to college, that's an investment. It's going to create lasting wealth for our entire nation when those kids graduate and become a productive part of the economy. Our experience with the GI Bill indicates that every dollar spent will return at least $7 and maybe as much as $50 back to government coffers in the form of income taxes from more productive and thus higher paid workers. Money put toward green energy projects, wind farms, solar plants, electric cars, these are all investments that will create a boatload of jobs. They reduce our demand for foreign oil and make our environment cleaner. Money put toward infrastructure, new roads, bridges, high-speed rail systems. These are not expenses. These are investments. They make it cheaper and easier for businesses to function in the United States, to ship goods across the country, or for citizens, for Americans to travel, go on vacation, get to work. Money put into healthcare research is an investment that will cut down on the costs the diseases inflict on our economy, and as a bonus, gives us a healthier and more productive workforce. Even money put towards social welfare programs like food stamps and unemployment benefits are actually investments. Moody's did research into this and found that for every dollar invested in expanding the food stamp program, the economy generates an extra $1.73. For every dollar invested in unemployment benefits, the economy generates an additional $1.64. That's from Moody's, not from some left-wing think tank. And that's a pretty good return on investment. President Obama uses the word investment a lot when referring to money put into educational programs, infrastructure, healthcare research, but you will never hear Republicans use the word investment. For them, it's always spending, spending, spending. Ever since Reagan said the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Ever since then, conservatives have been hell-bent on convincing all of us the government can't do anything right. That's all that all government can do is spend or waste money. It's a ridiculous talking point. It ignores an entire national history of worthwhile investments, from Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase to Lincoln's land-grant colleges to FDR's New Deal to Eisenhower's interstate highway system. All were investments made by our government that created enormous wealth, far more return than they cost in the long term for the nation in the form of new jobs, better education, more efficient transportation. And they all more than paid for themselves by the increase in tax revenues that comes with increased economic activity. But cons know that if they drag the name of government through the mud enough, then they can convince the American people, or at least some of them, that our American experiment in democratic governance is a failure. So when they get into office, they appoint lugheads like Brownie to head FEMA, and then point at FEMA's failures to justify trying to privatize it. Whether they call it austerity or starve the beast, the goal is the same. Slash government investments and let the private sector handle the work of building our national infrastructure, caring for our sick and elderly, transitioning to new energy. But rather than all this work being done for the public good, as the government would ensure, it will be done for profit for the fat cats on Wall Street. Today, with the so-called fiscal cliff looming, conservative budget hawks are still ignoring or lying about our government's role as an investor. Paul Ryan's budget, which is the Republican starting point for negotiations. They say, let's have massive cuts in Pell Grants, Medicare, green energy. These are investments. In the short term, Ryan's cuts will lower the deficit. But in the long term, those fewer investments will inflict serious damage on our nation. We stopped investing basically when Reagan took office. And 32 years of no longer investing in this country, our infrastructure is $2 trillion in the hole. Our country is starting to look like a third world nation. What is the American workforce going to look like 20 years from now with a million fewer college graduates? How much money is going to be wasted over the next 50 years on cancer-causing, climate-warming fossil fuels while we procrastinate clean energy? We've got to get this act together, and to do so, we have to understand the difference between spending and investing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So call up a Republican and explain it to them. Let me tell you about spending versus investing. And then let's have a national discussion about what we should invest in.
Hey, big spender. Spend a little time with me.
There you go. Yeah. It's, you know, is it spending? Is it investing? This is like, you know, just kind of a common sense thing. And then we've got this fiscal cliff hysteria. I want to address this. They're up to it again. This time they're calling it the fiscal cliff. Beware of con men bearing slogans. I mean, the oldest trick in the book is for cons, conservatives, to create hysteria about something and then get us to all give them billions of dollars to fix the problem that they made us hysterical about. And this is a con that these cons have been running for four generations. I'm sure they've been running it for much longer than that. But, you know, I think most of us are familiar with the four generations of it. They got us to spend, you know, four generations ago, in my grandfather's generation, this would be like in the 19-teens and 20s, they got us all hysterical about pot, reefer madness. They got us to spend trillions over the years incarcerating mostly poor people for mostly victimless crimes. They made a fortune doing it. And now they're even building private prisons full of potheads. Three generations ago, the right was whipping up hysteria about communism. Although Khrushchev never actually said, we will bury you, right-wingers and their PR machine made sure every American thought he did, and the Red Chinese were going to take down Vietnam, and that domino was going to flip over other countries from Laos to Canada, and pretty soon North Dakota would be filled with commies. They got us to spend trillions over the years building nukes and having pointless wars, but they made a fortune doing it. And now they're making money partnering with China. Now that they're doing that, they'd like us to forget that China's still officially a communist country. No droids in this car. Okay, so that was three generations ago. Two generations ago, the right wing was whipping up hysteria about taxes and regulation. Ronald Reagan told us that even though the decades of the 50s, 60s, and 70s had been the strongest in American history in terms of GDP growth and growth of the middle class, still, taxes on rich people were so high and regulation of industry was so bad that if we didn't do something about it now, then disasters would happen. Reagan got us to spend trillions giving tax breaks to billionaires, deregulated giant corporations so that they could destroy most small and medium-sized American businesses, in that great mergers and acquisitions frenzy that we refer to as the 80s. And they made a fortune doing it. And now in this generation, the right is whipping up hysteria about our national debt. They want us to be very afraid, that because of their war on drugs, because of their war on communism, because of their war on taxes and regulation, our country is now trillions of dollars in debt. It becomes particularly ironic when they get hysterical about a program that goes into effect at the end of this year this sequestration fiscal cliff thing that will modestly raise taxes back to where they were when Bill Clinton was president and will cut spending, particularly military spending, although not even close enough to take us back to where we were before Bush. They call this the fiscal cliff, as if it's something we could fall over the edge of and die from the crash. But it's all hysteria. The tax increases on middle-class people are easily remedied with a tax cut, something Republicans say they'd love. And the spending cuts sound like a lot, you know, over $1 trillion. But that's over the next 10 years. There's plenty of time to go through those things and decide which is important, like keeping long-term unemployment benefits flowing, and which can wait, like building more bombs. In other words, the fiscal cliff, another example of what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism. Create a panic and profit from it. For example, Wall Street is helping fund groups. The newest one is called the Third Way. Like they're hearkening back to Clinton or something. But no, this is actually a front group for Wall Street. They're pushing hard for us to give our Social Security Trust Fund, which has over $2.5 trillion in it with a T. They want us to give our Social Security Trust Fund to Goldman Sachs and Citibank so they can take care of it for us. Doesn't that make you all feel safe and warm and fuzzy? We do have a large debt, but it's not as big as it was after World War II. And how did we solve it then? Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, Democrat and Republican, both got it, that we were not facing a cliff. We didn't have a debt problem, even though debt was 127% of GDP. We had a jobs problem. So they invested billions of dollars in today's money in sending millions of Americans to college for free and billions more in building highways, schools, and hospitals. Those investments paid off in more and better jobs, which meant more taxpayers, which meant more tax revenue. And as if by magic, the World War II debt was paid off. You know, we need to change the conversation. We don't have a fiscal cliff to worry about. We have a jobs cliff. Giant corporations and their conservative buddies have been sending our jobs overseas as fast as they can. And while it's making the fat cats rich, it's wiping out the middle class. It's time for a national conversation about our insane trade policies and how we can grow real jobs, not just fast food jobs. We don't need to worry about the fiscal cliff. We don't need those thinking grand bargain. What we need is tariffs or a VAT tax to put Americans back to work. We need to once again protect American industry. Now, I know that there, you know, Republicans and Democrats, I've had Democratic politicians look me in the face and say, are you talking about protectionism? And my answer is yes. I am all in favor of protecting my country and protecting the companies that function in my company and in my country. And giving them the same protections that the United Kingdom gives their manufacturers, that France gives their manufacturers, that Germany gives their manufacturers, that China gives their manufacturers, that Japan gives. It's a really simple concept. You make imports expensive, you make exports cheap, and you build a manufacturing base. We did that from 1793 until the Ronald Reagan presidency. And then we went on Reaganomics. And for 32 years, we've been insane. For 32 years, wages of working people have stagnated while the rich have doubled and tripled their wealth. It's time to go back to sanity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, you know, if you think I'm wrong, if you disagree with me, call 877-378-CONS. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very omnilogently ugly, the good. Eureka Springs, Arkansas. On Monday, Eureka Springs became the first city in Arkansas to officially endorse marriage equality. A four-member majority of the city council approved the measure. Eureka Springs has a population of 2,300, and it's often called the San Francisco of Arkansas for both its physical resemblance to the city and its large LGBT population. Eureka Springs' decision to endorse marriage equality comes just weeks after another southern city, Austin, Texas, did the same thing. Both of these decisions show that support for marriage equality is spreading throughout America. Hopefully it won't be long before marriage equality is a right in our country. The bad. Wisconsin State Senator Alberta Darling. Darling was interviewed by a local Wisconsin TV station and was asked whether she thought voter suppression IDs would have made a difference for Wisconsin in the election. Do you have a clip of what she had to say, Shane? Here it is.
Do you think photo ID would have made any difference
Absolutely.
In the outcome of this election?
Yes, I think so. We're looking at all sorts of different precincts and all sorts of same-day registrations. And I know people will go, oh, we don't have fraud and abuse in our election. But why can't we have voter ID when the majority of our people in Wisconsin wanted it, we passed it, the governor signed it? Why should one judge in Dane County be able to hold it up?
Well, Mrs. Darling, one judge should be able to hold it up because voter suppression ID laws are unconstitutional. They deny Americans one of their most basic rights. The only way Republicans had a chance of winning big in the election was by using voter suppression tactics, and the statement by Ms. Darling just proves it. And the very, very ugly Wisconsin Republican lawmakers. Staying in Wisconsin, we move to some of Ms. Darling's colleagues, a group of Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin, nine of them to be exact, want to enact legislation that would make it a crime for federal officials to implement Obamacare in Wisconsin. The lawmakers stated their position in a questionnaire where they asked a fellow lawmakers, will you support legalization to nullify Obamacare, excuse me, legislation to nullify Obamacare and authorize state and local enforcement to arrest federal officials attempting to implement the unconstitutional health care scheme known as Obamacare? Yes, that's the real question. Well, first, the Supreme Court ruled that Obamacare is, in fact, constitutional. But more importantly, these officials are trying to deny the people of Wisconsin access to affordable and life-saving health care. And that is very, very ugly.
Man, that's incredibly ugly.
Hear that clip? No, Sean, or Shane, excuse me, of the phone call? Yeah, during our Free Speech TV break, one of our Free Speech TV viewers... who was it? Mike in Benson, Arizona, called in and played for us on the air a call he got. This is a robocall that he got, and here it is.
Obama's next 4 years makes you cringe. You need to hear this. We just learned that Obama's immediate plans are to close Guantanamo, give full amnesty to illegal aliens, and give the United Nations the authority to tax Americans. This is just in the short term. Our only recourse now is to move forward with the full impeachment of President Obama.
Oh,
we suspect that Obama is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors and that there may be grounds for impeachment as is laid out in the Constitution.
Yes, clearly.
Impeachment is our only option. As the nation's most effective conservative group, we are launching the official Impeach Obama campaign. So please press 1 now to donate to Impeach Obama.
And give us money.
Support. We'll send you a free gold shred on knee flag as a way of saying thank you for your support. Again, press 1 to donate to Impeach Obama now.
There you go.
Or press 9 to be removed.
Yeah, right. And if you press 9, then they may stop calling you, but I guarantee somebody else won't. Anyway, I this is hysterical. Obama is going to let the UN tax us. He's going to close Guantanamo. What was the third thing? There was something in the middle there. He's going to close Guantanamo. He's going to have the UN tax us all. We got to hear this again. Shane, Jim, and I are all sitting here in the room, and none of us can remember what the third one was, and it was equally hysterical. Let's just...
Obama's next 4 years makes you cringe. You need to hear this. We just learned that Obama's immediate plans are to close Guantanamo. Give full amnesty to illegal aliens.
Oh, full amnesty to illegal aliens. That's it. And then you let the UN... Yes. Oh, my. He's going to do what Ronald Reagan did. He's going to give full amnesty to illegal aliens. Oh, my goodness. It's incredible. Frank in Davison, Oklahoma. Hey, Frank, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Frank. What's on your mind?
That's good. A couple of things, if I could, please. One of the things is...
Pick one, please, because I got a whole bunch of callers who want to get in here.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. Well, what I was worrying about was, an infrastructure that President Obama's doing.
Right.
If he, you know, since he's making a contract, he can put a clause in there about just using American products only.
Right.
You know, they're made in America.
Yeah.
Like the steel and concrete and everything and the signs and paint.
Yep.
Everything goes in aluminum.
Yep.
For the guardrails.
There's two pieces of legislation, Frank, that are already law that apply to this. The first is the Davis-Bacon Act. The Davis-Bacon Act, I believe, was also passed in the 1930s, although it might have been the 40s. It's been around for quite some time. And it says that if you are going to use federal funds to do something, you have to pay the prevailing wage, which is typically the union wage, number one. And then secondly, the Buy America Act, which was passed in 1935 by the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration, the Buy America Act says explicitly that any government acquisitions, any government spending that is done with federal funds has to first source their products from American manufacturers and can only source from overseas manufacturers with a waiver if they can demonstrate that there are no American manufacturers. And frankly, during the Reagan administration, this was, I constantly say Reagan took us down the road of free trade. And this is one of the big ways that he did it, because he didn't, sign WTO. That was Bill Clinton. But it was Reagan who's basically started issuing blanket waivers on the Buy America Act for pretty much everything. And so federal spending is 20% of our total GDP. And so when the federal government buys something, it has consequence. And we could bring a lot of factories back if we simply started enforcing the Buy America Act, stopped issuing all these waivers. They have been routinely issued for virtually every federal department ever since the Reagan administration, and we need to stop making them routine and start making them really, really hard to get. Alex in Arlington, Virginia, and thanks for your call. Alex in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Oh, now your phone is working. Great.
Bojan, Polish-American for a long time in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked to my mom, a teacher from, she's retired now. And I just saw today in the Safeway, the 77 years old woman, she was working, and I told the woman, my mom, she was a teacher, and she can go twice a year to the like a spa sponsored by the union, by the workers' union.
Right.
But you don't have it in U.S. This is like a dream world for the Hollywood people.
Oh, I remember when I lived in Germany, people would take a health vacation for a week, and they go to these spas.
She does co-pay very, very small amount, but the resort is owned by the unions,
yeah.
The teachers' unions or the steel
yep.
workers' unions.
So your point, Alex.
In the U.S.
The point you wanted to make.
But I want to go back very quickly, because I know you have a very short time, about talking about small business, because I'm a small business owner in the United States,
right.
working extremely hard, 14 hours a day.
Right.
And, when we had this issue, about transfer of the contracts from the federal government, and also the banks got all the bailout. You remember mm-hmm. bailout banks?
Yeah, there were two tarps that George Bush signed. I remember them well.
But
one in September,
never
one
went
in October.
To the small business. And my professors from Europe, I contacted all the professors. They told me all the funds went to the speculation funds. They prefer to speculate than loan money to the small business like us,
right.
or any small business.
Right.
And another issue, which nobody talks on your show before, when, small business, we had the homes, we had the equity, mm-hmm. $14 trillion evaporated from the home equity loan. And now my clients, my friends, they told me I had a home, which was value $1 million, now is $500 million. No bank is going to loan me to my small business.
Right.
So that's a fundamental issue. No banks are willing to loan to the small business because the funds are evaporated from the home equity loan.
Yeah, I understand perfectly, Alex. I've run a bunch of small businesses in my life, and twice I tried to go to the Small Business Administration and get a loan or a line of credit. And, my businesses were too small It's like you got to have, you know, a small business in their mind is under 500 employees. And so I go in with, you know, 15 employees with, you know, a company that's doing $1 million or $2 million a year in business. And they're like, no, sorry, you don't qualify. And it's like, what? You know, but yeah, I'm with you. It's the Small Business Administration should be there for small businesses. Like your business. They should be there for businesses like your business.
Thank you very much.
Alex, thank you very much. Bye. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more on how do we explain to Republicans the difference between investing and spending? And how do we shift the national conversation to that topic? By the way, the number for our conservative call is 866-745-CONS, C-O-N-S. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day. President Obama has something to say to Lindsey Graham and John McCain.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Yes, let's check in with the news. The Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. And when you do so, be sure to shout out to Dana Siegelman, who's working so hard on behalf of her father. Tell her we said hi. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
It's great to see you again. How's everything?
Quite well. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Cold.
And in the world?
Yes.
The news of the world?
You know.
Yeah, I understand Mr. McCain and Mr. Graham are having a hissy fit about Susan
Rice. Well, we can go there. We can start there. Well, they're having a hissy fit, yes. And it started as a general hissy fit in the Senate, calling for a select committee on Benghazi, as you do, along with Kelly Ayotte, who's joining them in the hissy fit. She is, of course, the senator from New Hampshire, one of the girl power group in New Hampshire, which is terrific. So there are three of them are calling for a select committee on Benghazi. So the president was asked about this in his news conference, which is news because he doesn't tend to have them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not happy about this.
Yes. He said it was outrageous, didn't he?
It wasn't so much that that made him outrageous. It was the second part of the question, because the corollary to the question had to do with John McCain's attack on UN Ambassador Susan Rice.
Right.
And her going on the television and talking about Benghazi. And when she did, as you'll remember, and your audience will remember, she did so based on talking points she was given based on intelligence that the CIA had at the time about the Benghazi attacks,
mm-hmm.
which was the most recent intelligence the CIA had. That's what she had. So that's what she said. Now, it turns out that wasn't accurate.
Oh, my.
So that's what she had. So
had she said nothing, the press would have criticized her for participating in a cover-up, and she tells them what she thinks she knows, and they're criticizing her that she was wrong.
Right. So he said if Senator McCain and Senator Graham and others want to go after somebody, they should go after me. And he stuck his chin up like this. And I'm happy to have that discussion with them. But for them to go after the UN ambassador who had nothing to do with Benghazi and was simply making a presentation based on intelligence that she had received and to besmirch her reputation is outrageous. Then he said when they go after the UN ambassador because they think she's an easy target, then they've got a problem with me. He also went on to say, because there was the question of whether he might nominate her to be Secretary of State, and that, of course, McCain's saying that he would block that, basically saying if he feels like it, he will, but that he hasn't made a decision yet.
Right.
Everybody in the press feels, of course, he's made a decision. We don't know what the decision is. Nobody really believes that.
Now, the question that this raises, given that the Democrats have 55 seats in the Senate, and it takes 60 votes to overcome a filibuster under the current rules.
Yeah.
And nominations have to be approved by the Senate for cabinet officials, which would be secretaries of state. Is Harry Reid going to change the filibuster rules so that, you know, Republicans, they could filibuster, but they have to stand there for all that? Eventually, President Obama can get past a filibuster.
I don't know whether he will. my feeling, and this is based on nothing other than instinct, and my instinct may not be good because I don't really understand the man. I think he might not, because he's increased his majority. He's closer to 60. I think if he was lower, I think he might have done, but he's closer to 60. I think he might feel he's more able to get a deal. So why risk it? Because it could come back to bite you.
Yeah. Could be. I think that he will change them so that if you're going, so that it becomes what everybody thinks it is, you know, the Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of filibuster, where the senator actually has to stand there and talk. And when he stops talking, then that's considered the end of debate. Debate is cut off and a vote happens.
That I think he might do, the phone book filibuster.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that I think makes sense. But the getting rid of it, I think, you know, the nuclear option, I don't think he'll do that.
I agree with you. But if he does change it that way, that's going to functionally eliminate the ability of Republicans to obstruct anything for, you know, years and years, as they've been doing for the last couple of years in the Senate.
Yes. Also at the press conference, I'm not going Benghazi. I'm not going sex scandal. I'm not going fiscal cliff. For you, Tom, I'm going climate change.
Okay.
Because it actually came up.
Yeah, which is pretty impressive. And President Obama was pretty forceful in his assertion that climate change is real. And that while we can't point to any particular storm as being that's the one, that it's real and that and humans are causing it, we need to do something about it.
Yes. He said we'll be having conversations to find out what more we can do to make short-term progress in reducing carbon, then working through an education process across the country. He did say, though, that he didn't know how Republicans or Democrats will react, not just because of party, but because of regional differences. And he said there's no doubt that taking on climate change right now would require some tough political choices.
Right. In other words, he's going to lose coal country and oil country.
I think he realizes that. He also said that it's not something that he would prioritize over jobs, but he did indicate that it could sort of happen in tandem with.
That would be interesting.
That I thought was quite interesting.
Well, that's where, you know, rather than a carbon tax, that's where cap and trade comes in. I mean, cap and trade was first proposed by, as I recall, George Herbert Walker Bush as a way of getting, you know, with a cap and trade program on sulfur dioxide. And it worked really well. It actually increased employment because they started making these scrubbers for the smokestacks. It reduced the sulfur dioxide. The banksters loved it because they're still to this day trading in sulfur dioxide futures and options and things. I mean, you know, this is an old Republican idea.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So.
Also today, Nancy Pelosi announced that she will run again as House Minority Leader. I don't think anyone will run against her, so I think she's a shoo-in.
That's
age
great.
72.
Yep. And she's acting like half that age. I mean, she is so energetic and so enthusiastic and such a good legislator. So, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you as always. And check out free-don.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. And Dr. Richard, we're going to do an hour here on economics and do it seriously and do it rationally and do it thoughtfully and insightfully and all that stuff. Dr. Richard Wolff is on the line with us. He's an economist. He's professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City, and author of numerous books, including his latest, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Dr. Wolff, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
I'm very pleased to have you with us. And did by the way, since you're going to be with us through the whole hour, did our call screener explain to you that when the music starts, we've got to wrap up and there's hard breaks and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, they do.
Okay, great. So you've got the whole shtick here.
Yeah.
Great. I'm curious. You know, we've talked a lot about this on the TV program, but not so much on radio. What do you see as the biggest economic problem right now facing the United States or facing the United States and the world?
Well, I think that we've come to a bit of a crossroads in the American economy. We have had an economic system that worked really pretty well for about 100 years, from the 1850s to the 1970s. All things considered, it had many bumps, and the big one in the Great Depression. But even across the Depression, the wages of American workers steadily rose. That stopped in the 1970s as American employers found cheaper workers elsewhere in the world, and they didn't need the American working class the way they had before. Wages stopped rising in the 1970s, real wages, and they never resumed. And what happened was that the American working class was told that if they wanted to enjoy the American dream, they'd have to borrow money like it has never been done before, which they did. But in the end, you cannot keep borrowing on a basically flat wage because you will be unable to, in the end, pay those debts or cover the interest. And in 2007, this kind of system broke down. And it didn't just break down in a short-term business cycle the way Presidents Bush and Obama had said it would and had hoped it would. It showed us this long-term change in America, in which a decision based on profits by our business leaders, is now showing us the long-term consequences, and it's a question of economic decline. So to answer your question, I think the question is whether the American people, the vast majority, are ready to accept a long-term slide in their standards of living, what they can afford, what they can give their kids, or whether they're going to say, no, there has to be a change in an economic system that works this way. And I think that's the big issue that is being faced, you know, across Europe today. There are demonstrations by the millions in every major European city on just this question. And I think it's only a matter of time before that question impresses itself on the American people in a way that will confront us all with very basic decisions.
Would it be reasonable to say that what we're seeing is the economic a clash of economic worldviews between that of Galbraith and Keynes versus that of Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand?
I think that's one of them. But I actually think it's a kind of a multiple set of confrontations. Yes. That one which says that the way you deal with an economic crisis is you crunch down on the economy, you take the society over a fiscal cliff, to use the phrase we're talking about in our country, you impose austerity, which is the way they say it in Europe, versus the Keynesians or the Galbraithians who say, no, the time of crisis is when you pump money to the mass of people and you build up the economy from below. But at the same time, there is an even more fundamental question, which is whether a system of economics that puts the decisive power in the hands basically of a tiny minority, the major shareholders, the boards of directors of the 500 largest corporations in the United States, they make all the key economic decisions, what to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Are we as a nation, this other question and confrontation says, are we as a nation willing to continue leaving all that economic power, all that economic discretion in the hands of that minority, the 1%, especially now, given that we're entering the sixth year of an economic downturn that has cost so many people their jobs, their homes, their job security, and so on. So I think there are multiple profound questions agitating the underlying reality of America today.
Well, and perhaps there's a larger frame that we can put around this. In the game of monopoly, which is kind of what these 500 corporations you're talking about are playing, in the game of monopoly, when you end up owning all of the properties, the other players no longer have the ability to earn income from their rents, if we want to get into Henry George here. And as a consequence of that, they're broke. You know, you got one left standing, but even that one left standing, the game ends. It's not like, you know, at the end of a Monopoly game, I mean, the person ends up with all the money, but the game ends. Are we looking at a game end? Are we looking at a great crash if we don't do something about this?
Well, you know, I'm not given to that way of thinking, so perhaps there's some meaning when I answer your question. Yes, I think we may well be at a point in the economic development of modern capitalism where it has painted itself into a corner, where it really has to discover yet again that if you do exactly as you say, Tom, if you bankrupt everybody else, in the end, you will destroy yourself as well. It's sort of the old story that we tell children about the Midas touch, about the greedy king who wanted everything he touched to turn to gold. And then he finally, you know, embraced his beloved daughter, and she wasn't a real person anymore because she had changed into gold too.
Right.
The Germans, for example, are learning that if you bankrupt the rest of Europe, and yet you have to sell to the best of, to the rest of Europe to survive, it's going to eventually strangle your own economy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're discovering in the United States that if you impoverish the mass of people bit by bit, year by year, in the end, they won't be able to be the consumers you as a businessman or woman need them to be if you're going to survive yourself. But you know, that's when we look back on all the other empires in the world, the British Empire, the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, the Chinese empires, we all wonder when we look back at them, why didn't they take the steps that seem obvious to us that might have avoided the end, the collapse of their empires? And I have to wonder with you whether we are not at that kind of moment in the United States where we seem like deer caught in the headlights of an oncoming car, unable to see that we must break out of an existing system or its decline is going to take us with it.
Right. So we have just a minute to a very, very brief break. But what do we do?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that for some years. The book you kindly mentioned at the beginning, you know, Democracy at Work.
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer is we finally have to do what I like to call completing the democratic revolution, not limiting democracy to just where we live and to our politics, but bringing it, if we really believe in it, as I do, bringing it into the economy too. And if the people who make up an enterprise are 5,000 strong, then democracy means we all together in that enterprise make its basic decisions. We don't leave them to a tiny minority of boards of directors and major shareholders. They had their chance. They built up the economic system, but it's no longer working. And maybe if we introduce democracy to the economy, we can have the kind of rebirth of our societies that we achieved when we brought democracy instead of autocracy into our political life.
Okay, and we'll get into more detail in just a few minutes about how we do that. It's our Conversations with Great Minds Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program with Dr. Richard Wolff. His website, by the way, rdwolf with two Fs.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Dr. Wolff, also his most recent book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Check it out. We'll be right back with Dr. Wolff in just a second. Back to our Conversations with Great Minds. Today, Dr. Richard Wolff for the hour, professor of economics, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor of the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City, author of numerous books, including his latest brilliant work, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. His website, rdwolff with two Fs.com. Professor Wolff, if I can just very quickly summarize and correct me if I make any mistakes here, that the United States, uniquely among many democracies around the world, had basically a labor shortage from more or less our founding up until the 1970s, which is why there's all these immigrants here. You know, people came from all over the world because there was a labor shortage, and employers were competing for labor, and so wages were continuously rising. and thus, you know, we had this growing, steadily growing middle class. And all that came to a screeching halt in the 1970s, and you said that there are four reasons why. First of all, did I get everything right? And secondly, you want to get into those four reasons.
Yep, you got it perfectly right. So we have to explain what happened in the 1970s to basically end the labor shortage. And by ending the labor shortage, the message was sent to every employer, you don't have to raise wages anymore because we have an excess of people. And everybody who works knows that if he or she pushes for higher wages, the employer can always go and find among those people that are now extra in the society substitutes for those who are dissatisfied. And so employers didn't have to raise wages anymore, and they haven't done so for the last 30 years. So what were the four reasons? Very quickly. Number one, employers stopped hiring Americans. That is, huge numbers of them moved production out of the United States and reset up their factories, their offices, their stores in other countries. Wherever the labor was cheaper or cheapest, they would move. And that meant that the demand for workers here in the United States dropped. The second thing that happened in the 1970s was the beginning of a major wave of automation, of replacing American workers with the latest new technological breakthrough, namely the computer. Jobs that used to require 50 people could now be done by one person working in front of a computer terminal. So those two phenomena, moving jobs abroad and replacing workers with machines, drastically reduced the need for workers. And ironically, at the same time, two new groups of people added to the supply of people looking for jobs. The beginning of the mass movement of American adult women who wanted equal opportunity, who wanted jobs in the paid labor force, were no longer willing to be only homemakers, mothers, wives, and so on, meant that millions and millions of American women moved into the paid labor force. And finally, we had a new wave of immigration, not from Europe this time, mostly from Latin America, coming north into the United States looking for work. Well, if you put together the loss of job opportunities because of the movement of production out of the country and the replacement of workers with computers on the one hand, and the arrival of millions of women and new immigrants from Latin America on the other, you have what we economists call a decline in the demand for workers and a rise in the supply of people looking for work. That's a recipe for the end of rising wages.
All right. This is David Ricardo on
labor.
That's
right. It's not that complicated once you see what the basic movements here are.
Right.
And you know, what Americans could have and should have done in the 70s, but we didn't do as a nation, is face this reality. Say to ourselves, my goodness, our historic situation is changed. What are we going to do? Either the mass of people are going to have to do without the goods and services that define the American dream, or they're going to have to find another way to achieve them. The irony is we never had a conversation on the national level. None of our leaders either saw this or were willing to discuss it. So Americans took individual decisions. And what most of Americans did is two things. Work more hours to compensate for the fact that wages weren't going out, and send more members of the family out to work. And the second thing, the crucial thing, is to achieve the American dream by borrowing more and more money.
Right.
Borrow to buy your house, borrow to buy your car, borrow everything through a credit card, and the most recent stunning phenomena, go into the deepest debt imaginable to give your kids the education that the American dream always included. And by 2007, we had the end result. Americans had taken on more debt than their flat wages would allow them to pay. And now we're living with the consequences.
Now, Time magazine in the 1960s, I think it was 67, had a really interesting cover story about the coming leisure society. They pointed out that because of machinery, starting with Eli Whitney's cotton gin, and these incremental increases in productivity, that the American workers were now so much more, the consequence of increasing productivity per worker was a decreasing number of hours needed to work every week to get the same income. So we went from the 60 or 70 hour week, or arguably the 80 or 90 hour week back in the early 19th century, to the 60 hour week, to the 50 hour week at the beginning of the 20th century, to the 40 hour week. And they said that if this increase in productivity continues, we'll be at a 25-hour week, and people will have leisure because wages will remain the same. Now, I understand that if CEO pay and dividends had not gone up as much as they have since the 70s, that wages actually would have gone up or working hours could have gone down. Do I have that wrong?
No, you have it exactly right. And, you know, it's a wonderful indictment of the capitalist system. We have become more productive. We have used the machines, including the computer, to make it possible for a single worker to produce more output today than he or she could 5 years ago, and that more than 10 years ago, and so on. And every increase in productivity should have made it possible, and the defenders of productivity have always said this, should have made it possible to do less labor and still get the same amount of output, thereby freeing human beings from the burden of work. But it's an indictment of capitalism that didn't work out that way, that Americans are in fact doing more hours of labor today than they did 5, 10, and 15 years ago.
Remarkable.
It has not only not freed us from labor, our growing productivity, but it's a peculiarity of our capitalist system that we are ending up doing more labor. Here's a statistic.
Remarkable. Hang on just a second. Dr. Wolf, we have to pick this up on the other side of the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're taking a six-minute break here for our stations to go to local news and commercials and information. We'll be back with more of Dr. Richard Wolf, and he'll be taking your calls as well.
No barrier between the greatest mind and mind. The universe is open all the time.
Welcome back. It's our Conversations with Great Minds Hour with Dr. Richard Wolf, economist, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor at the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City, author of numerous books, including his latest Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. You can read all about it on his website at rdwolf, that's with two Fs, WOLFF.com. And Professor Wolf, first of all, thank you for staying with us.
Oh, and, my pleasure.
And you were kind of on a roll when we hit that break. Do you want to finish that thought, just recap it very quickly, and then we can pick up some phone calls, or if there are, unless there are other things that you think need to be said before any further questions are asked?
Well, I think the basic thing that I want to stress is that in our economic system, as workers became more productive over the period from 1800 to 1970, their wages went up. And that, another way of saying that is workers participated in their growing productivity. They worked hard, they learned more techniques, they had more machines to work with, but their wages went up with their productivity. Since the 1970s, my apologies for the noise.
Right.
Since the 1970s, workers have continued to become more productive, but their wages didn't go up anymore. All their growing productivity didn't get them leisure. They're working harder now than ever before. According to the OECD, a major institution keeping statistical records around the world, Americans do more hours of paid labor per year than the working people in any other country on this planet. So rising productivity of our workers has not brought them the leisure that was promised. If anything, it has brought them more and more labor, and over the last 5 years, harder and harder economic times. For me, that's a sign of an exhausted economic system that we need to question and debate in a way we have not done for 50 years, and it's long overdue so that we can face up to our problems, which is always the first step in overcoming them.
And what would be your remedy for this?
Well, that's what I write up in the book, Democracy at Work. I really mean it. I think working people can and should be in the position to make collectively the decisions of what is done in our productive enterprises, our stores, our offices, our factories. The reality is that we all as a people have to live with the results of the economic decisions that are made. And yet we allow them to be made in the interests of the major shareholders, who are very few, and in the interests of the boards of directors they select, which as a percentage of the population is tiny, tiny, less than 0.1%. And I think that's the root of our problem. And I think the beginning of a solution, now is to change the way we organize our enterprises, to systematically explore the cooperative way of building business as a surer road to make sure that the economic decisions that we take are made by the mass of people democratically, because if they're not, they will continue to favor only a tiny minority at the expense of all of the rest of us, and it is now becoming a very serious threat to what we used to call the American way of life.
Yeah, brilliantly said. Well, let's pick up some phone calls and get some of our viewers and listeners in here. Ed, watching us on Free Speech TV in Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air with Dr. Wolf.
Hi, Dr. Wolf. I love your work, and I appreciate everything you have to say. My question is, like, as someone interested in activism or whatever and the kind of language that we use, and it seems like America has an allergy to the word socialism, and I notice you use the word democracy, but that's used all the time. What, you know, moving forward, you know, I consider myself a democratic socialist, but I don't know if that language is harmful or we should just use it more and more and try to explain it better and better and try to change the debate.
Okay, let's get Dr. Wolf in on this, Ed. Thank you very much for the call. Dr. Wolf?
Well, I think it's a very important question. And I think the way to begin to deal with it is to recognize two fundamental facts. First, to admit and to not shy away from the fact that in the name of socialism and communism over the 20th century, some pretty awful things were done. And there has to be a reckoning about that. We have to either decide not to use the terms anymore as a kind of nod to the things that were done that were awful, or, as you put it, we have to change the language so that these words are given the kind of meaning we want them to have and not the meaning that is attached to them because of the disasters that some who use that word achieved, let's put it that way. The second issue is that for 70 years now, almost 60 years for sure, it has been a taboo here in the United States. It has been impossible for Americans to have an honest, open debate about the capitalist system and its alternatives like socialism. Every time this issue came up over the last 50 years, anyone who expressed criticism of capitalism or an interest in socialism was dealt with as either ignorant or a traitor or a spy or something awful. And so, of course, it shut down the conversation. And if you don't debate a system that you live with, then you tend to give that system a free pass, and it can indulge its worst tendencies. We're living with the results now of a capitalism that escaped the kind of honest debate and honest criticism that it ought to have. We didn't do ourselves any service by refusing to debate and discuss socialism. So my own hope is that we overcome that, we grow up, we learn the ability to reject those kinds of socialism we don't want without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, with being able to talk about socialism as having things for us to learn from, just like the capitalism we criticize has things for us to learn from, and develop that debate, making up for all the lost time of the last 50 years when we couldn't have it.
Okay. Mark in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. You are on the air with Dr. Richard Wolf.
Hi, Tom. It's Mark Taylor Canfield. This is a great show. I really appreciate what you guys are doing to expose this information because it's really not something that is discussed in politics or the media. And so I have a quick comment and then a question. First of all, you know, there is another issue here, which is that I think a lot of folks are realizing that the system just isn't working for them. And you know, witness the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Sandy. And by the way, a shout out to the Occupy Wall Street folks who are volunteering to help everyone, so hey to everybody at Occupy Sandy, keep up the good work. But I wrote an article for the Seattle Times asking the voters in the U.S. to join with the folks in Europe and around the rest of the world that are trying to fight these worldwide austerity measures, because the cuts to education, healthcare, social services, and bailing out the banksters, multinationals, is all happening all over the world.
So your question for Dr. Wolf, Mark?
My question is don't you think also that in order, and it seems like you're moving towards this point anyway, don't you think that in order to address the corruption in the banking system and in the economic system that we also are going to need to change our electoral system? And isn't the real question, well, is the system working for the majority of the people?
Yeah. Dr. Wolf?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That is the fundamental question, and I think that the last 5 years do give us an unambiguous answer that whatever this system is achieving, providing a better life for the mass of the American people, is not among the outputs of the last 5 years. And hence, I believe that millions of Americans are asking these questions and coming to new conclusions. I think Occupy Wall Street is a sign of that. I think the popularity of Tom Hartman is a sign of that. And there are dozens of other signs of this kind of awakening, if you like it, or rediscovery. Let me add a word about Sandy. I live in New York City. I live in an apartment in which for a week we had no power, no heat, no hot water, and no telephone service. I was astonished that after 10 years of Homeland Security designed to help us as a nation cope with emergencies and disasters, the federal government, the state government, and the city government here were unable to come in and help people in anything like the way they could have and they should have. We've had the result of $60 billion worth of losses from this storm. For a tiny fraction of that, we could have had the preparedness, the people, and the resources to help. We still have tens of thousands of people without power and heat. The temperatures are low. It is in its own way, as you suggested, an indictment of a system that in more and more areas cannot work in the way we are capable of and that we need as a nation.
Yeah. Yeah. We have just a minute before the break. Again, what's the alternative?
Well, again, for me, the basic answer is you cannot allow the economic resources of the nation, the wealth, the enterprises, to be under the control of tiny groups of people. We really can't be surprised.
How do we take it from them?
That the decisions are made by them for them. The alternative is the collective democratic organization of enterprises. I think that's the fundamental. And so that these democratically run enterprises can work together with democratically run cities and states to reorganize the economy and make it work for everyone by removing the decision-making apparatus we have now, which isn't democratic and therefore has to be questioned, especially when it produces such poor results.
Yeah, brilliant. Dr. Richard Wolf is with us in our Conversations with Great Minds Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We will be back in just a moment with more of Dr. Wolf. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can find Dr. Wolf's new book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, pretty much everywhere, but also at his website, rdwolf2fs.com.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Conversations with Great Minds Hour with Dr. Richard Wolf. Check out his website, rdwolf.com. And Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching us on Free Speech TV on Dish Network. You're on the air with Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, how you doing, Dr. Wolf? I'm a big admirer of your economic thinking. My question is, wouldn't a simpler... maybe less effective, but a simpler solution to our problems be to redistribute the wealth from the billionaires and the 100 millionaires who call themselves job creators, but they're really job killers? Wouldn't a simpler solution be to redistribute the wealth back to working people of this country?
Do we need a jubilee, sir?
Well, I was just about to say that, Tom. You and I seem to be thinking alike today. You know, in ancient times, back in the era of the Greeks and the Romans, and in the Christian tradition too, there is this notion of jubilee, that you have periodically to deal with the inequality that creeps into your community and threatens to disrupt it and set people against each other, stoking the fires of envy and resentment, that you have to deal with that by periodically redistributing the wealth, taking it away from those who have gathered too much and passing it out to those who didn't get so much, so that we go back to the roughly equal status that can allow us to be a community without such differences. And we ought to listen to that long tradition that's very ancient, because it might have a lesson for us along the lines you say. But I would have this caution or disagreement perhaps with you. It isn't enough to redistribute the wealth, because if that's all you do, then you leave in place the same mechanisms. You're going to have that split between successful and unsuccessful, rich and poor, simply recur within the next few years. We want something which will give everybody an equal starting point, a level playing field, and then we'll work in such a way that we don't ever get the problem of having to take stuff away from some people to help other people, because we guarantee the kinds of economic system that gives some people more and some people less, but nothing like the grotesque situation today, for example, where 10% of our wealthiest people own 75% of the wealth of this society and things like that. So you need to both change the system and get us back to start at an equal starting point, so everybody has an equal chance in order to solve the kinds of problems we have.
Jim in Madera, California, listening to Sirius XM. You're on the air with Dr. Wolf.
Well, actually, I kind of have a point to make. I owned a window and door company for 30 years, and, you know, I always grossed between $1 and $2 million. And so I paid a lot of taxes, but it's been my expense when the taxes were a little bit higher. Well, when money was cheap or taxes were cheap, I would pull the money out of the business. But when I was forced to pay a little bit higher taxes, I left money in the business so I wouldn't have to pay the taxes. So I argue that having a little bit higher taxes will encourage growth, especially on, you know, single entrepreneurs that are just, you know, right in the area I was in.
Yeah, I've had that same experience, Jim. Yes. Dr. Wolf?
And let me comment on it in terms of history. Your question is very well taken. The rates of taxation on both businesses in America and on the wealthiest people were much, much higher in the 1960s and 70s than they are today, particularly in the 1960s. And if you compare the economic growth rate of the 1960s to today, we were much more of a growing economy at that time. The conservatives constantly misunderstand by imagining that lower taxes on business and the rich are some sort of guarantee of low economic growth. That's not the history of the United States. The best growth periods after World War II for the American economy occurred together with high taxes on corporations and the rich, and the government using that tax money to create growth supports, high demand, the very things that businesses need to have the confidence to grow.
Yeah. Dr. Wolf, I still have a dozen people here on the board who want to talk to you. In other words, we're slammed, but we only have 2 minutes until the end of the hour and the end of the show today. I'd like to toss those to you as an opportunity to recap and summarize and put forward suggestions. What individuals can do moving forward? What can we do?
Well, the single most important thing that I stress is that stop thinking as though what the Republicans and the Democrats say in Congress, what the newspapers reprint, and what the professors who want to please those folks keep saying, stop thinking within those limits. If ever the term thinking outside the box had any meaning, it means think outside the box of conventional wisdom. We do not have an economic system, capitalism, that is delivering the goods. It did that once for most Americans. It doesn't do it anymore. And we have to be courageous enough as a people to face that, to look at the alternatives that people like me and many others are putting forward, to think in terms of changing. Let me conclude with an example. The most effective organized help that is being provided to the people of the New York area to recover from Sandy is being done by Occupy Wall Street volunteers. They have been heroes and heroines. They have taken the spirit of their critique of the 1% versus 99% society and shown that committed people in large numbers can democratically help solve the problems of this society in an immediate and obvious way. That's the lesson I think Americans ought to focus on, and if they do, I'm confident that they will come up with the organizations and the programs to take the society in a new and better direction.
Absolutely brilliant. Dr. Richard Wolff, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Tom, for maintaining this kind of programming, which is more important now in our history than ever before.
Well, thank you. We're going to keep doing it as long as we can. Dr. Richard Wolff, check out his website, rdwolff.com. And coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, California's Prop 8 is hanging in the balance at the Supreme Court. Four states legalized marriage equality. Family Research Council is calling for civil disobedience to block same-sex marriage. I'm going to challenge Dr. Michael Brown about this. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.